professor of sociology at the University of Warwick, and is renowned internationally for his work on sociology of science. And he's been drawn my attention in recent years because of his work on the controversies surrounding intelligent design and creationism. And his most recent publications have addressed those particular issues. I'm thinking here of his book Science versus Religion, Intelligent Design and the Problem of Evolution, and Descent Over Dissent, Intelligent Design's Challenge to Darwinism. Steve is going to talk to us this evening about the notion of intelligibility within the intelligent design debate. And specifically, his title, which I have to remind myself of.
And me as well.
And you as well, yes. Is Intelligent Design Theory and Imago Dei, Prolegomena to a Creationist Left. I hope you join me in welcoming Steve Fuller.
First, let me thank Matthew for this introduction and for inviting me to speak to you. I should say I'm taping this. I hope this isn't a problem for anyone. And also, I'll be recording the questions as well, and I'll be putting this on my website along with the PowerPoint presentation that you'll be seeing here. I have the PowerPoint up there largely to sort of hit at the basic points that I'm raising in the talk, but I will try to sort of present matters in a relatively informal way, and so maybe not everything that is up there will actually be covered what I say in the 45 minutes or so that I'll be speaking to you, but feel free to ask questions about it. What I want to do in this talk is basically indicate why intelligent design theory is a very intrinsically interesting development beyond just the sort of immediate political circumstances under which it has gained a lot of attention in the United States and increasingly in Europe. And in order to do that, what I'm going to do is put intelligent design in a very large context, because I think, in fact, intelligent design has been the driving, motivating force for doing science in the West. And that to a large extent, that motivating force has been, you might say, to a certain extent, sublimated, secularized, maybe even lost. But now it's being revived again. And I think one rather charitable way of seeing what intelligent design theory is trying to do is, in a sense, to do something like what the Protestant Reformation did for Christianity, only to science. Okay, and that's kind of, I think, the most positive image, and this is why I'm talking about a left creationism here. The first point to make is I do not deny intelligent design theory's connections to creationism. I think historically it makes perfect sense, not only in the contemporary context in terms of the actual beliefs of people who are the proponents of intelligent design. I mean, they may believe in evolution to a certain extent, but it's quite clear they also do believe in a creative God of the sort of the Abrahamic faiths. I think that's pretty clear. I think for political reasons in the United States, it's not very advisable to talk about this in a scientific context, but that doesn't deny that sort of background. And I don't think there's anything necessarily to be ashamed of in bringing that up. Because when we talk about intelligent design theory, it seems to me that the important explanatory concept is going to be the intelligent designer and who exactly that being is. And in that respect, I think Richard Dawkins, in his book The God Delusion, where he keeps on brandishing the flying spaghetti monster as a possible candidate for the intelligent designer, because intelligent design theorists are rather coy about talking about who the intelligent designer is. They say, well, might as well be the flying spaghetti monster. And of course, I think that's a very telling objection, because it is quite clearly a sort of God that one finds in the Abrahamic faith, in whose image and likeness we were created. So in other words, the kind of God that we're talking about, who's the intelligent designer in intelligent design theory, is like a very big version of ourselves. Okay? And I think that's a very important point to keep in mind, and it helps to explain the kind of people who are attracted to this kind of idea, and it also explains quite a lot about how the scientific revolution took off in the West. So what I say in the first line there is, what is intelligent design theory? Well, it's the idea that biology is divine technology. Okay, so we're getting a very strong kind of comparison being made here between humans as artificers and God as artificer. Okay, and so we're going to start thinking about organisms literally as machines. Okay, so Michael Behe, he has this idea that the cell is irreducibly complex in the same sense as a mousetrap. Okay, now the interesting thing isn't whether or not the cell is in fact irreducibly complex. It's the fact that he's comparing it to a mousetrap. Okay, that's very interesting. The mechanism, the mechanistic worldview, which is, of course, very crucial for the scientific revolution, is very much part of what intelligent design theory is onto. Also, the idea that life is literally a code, right? So the genetic code is a language. And if you look at some of the research that's being done by geneticists who are, in fact, influenced by intelligent design theory, there's now this Biologic Institute that's been funded by the Discovery Institute. They are definitely trying to figure out, okay, what is the nature of the code, and sort of figuring out what is the language of the genes, and being very literal minded. So they're exploring with the possibility that it might not be an alphabetic code, but it might be something like the ideograms in Chinese. Okay, so they're actually really taking that linguistic analogy very literally. Okay, and also, and as I was just alluding to earlier, right, God creates in the sense that we do, only does it much, much, much better. God is the ultimate engineer. And who is attracted to intelligent design theory? Well, a lot of engineers are, a lot of chemists are, okay? The people who come into genetics from molecular biology and those areas where there's a large sort of technological component to working with life are very much attracted to this kind of theory. Not people who work in field biology or the areas that were part of Darwin's original expertise, okay, where you're looking at life in the native habitat and you're far away from a laboratory. Those people are not attracted to intelligent design at all, and draw a very sharp distinction between mechanism and organism. Okay. Now, in the theological literature, one talks about from the Middle Ages, at the very end of the talk, I'm going to sort of go back to this kind of idea, the idea of the univocity of being. This has to do with whether one can actually make direct reference to God. In what sense can one talk about God? Can one only talk about God analogically or equivocally because our language is inadequate to capture that? And so we say that God is all-powerful, but the sense of powerful is not the same sense as we mean to ourselves. Okay, and that was a kind of view of Thomas Aquinas and people of that kind. But there's another kind of view, which was in fact a view that was very influential in the scientific revolution, which pointed to the univocity of being. That there's a sense in which when we talk about God's omnipotence, for example, we're talking about God as being the ultimately most powerful being, but powerful in the same sense that we have power. It's just God is infinitely extended version of it. Okay, and then the whole point about what God is God is the convergence of the ultimacy of all of these virtues, which in human beings and other creatures are distributed differently. So God is all-powerful, all-knowing, etc., all combined in one being, whereas differences in the capacity to know, differences in capacity for power are distributed across creatures. And this is a view that was associated very much with John Duns Scotus in critique of Thomas Aquinas. Now, this view of the univocity of being is very much behind intelligent design theory, and this is why what other scientists and other religious people might treat as analogies or metaphors is treated literally here. Okay, so with regard, if you go to the main blog that's devoted to intelligent design theory called Uncommon Descent that William Dembski runs, you get one of these trademark pictures of the bacterial flagellum, you know, as an outboard motor, right, in a very mechanistic way. Well, actually, I think that's literally how intelligent design theory sees the world. Okay, that's how it, you know, mechanism, real mechanism. And that you can make those kinds of mechanical models through computer simulations is a kind of demonstration of intelligent design. Okay, it's not just a metaphor or picture or an imaginary representation, but it is capturing how the thing is actually constructed. Okay, this is one way of interpreting the idea that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God, right? Namely, that we partake of certain kinds of divine powers, not to the same extent that God does. God does it to an infinite, ultimate extent. But we do so to a limited extent. And that is the sort of interpretation that one gives to that idea. And that was certainly the interpretation that was very empowering during the scientific revolution. Now, this has a lot to do in addition with another phenomenon, which I'm alluded to in the fourth point, and that is to say the ability to take science into one's hands, to take the authoritative forms of knowledge into one's hands and interpret them for oneself. Now, of course, a very important thing that led up to the scientific revolution was the printing press and availability of Bibles in the natural languages of people, so that people didn't have the Bible mediated to them through priests in Latin, but were able to read the Bible for themselves, and as it were, read it as something that addressed them directly. And in fact, very much the Protestant Reformation was about the Bible speaking to you directly and then you responding to it. And so the whole idea is that you have to somehow see yourself as scripted in this book. And this is quite an innovation in terms of how Protestantism moved away from Catholicism, okay, where it wasn't a lot of Bible reading and a lot of personal address in the Bible. But I think it's very clear that if you look at the sort of theological views of major figures in the scientific revolution, and Isaac Newton really stands out in this regard, he took it very personally that he was created in the image and likeness of God, to the extent that he thought he could get into the mind of God and sort of, as it were, try to understand the world from that kind of perspective. Okay, and I'm going to say a bit more about that later, but I think that's a very important kind of literal reading of being created in the image and likeness of God, that we can actually partake of some divine qualities. Now, nowadays, in terms of the way in which... So this obviously, the proliferation of the Bible in the natural languages enabled people to interpret things for themselves and not to have to rely on clerical authority speaking in languages they didn't understand. And that was a very important point in terms of creating lots of different ways of understanding how nature operated. Now, nowadays, of course, we have something quite similar with regard to the internet, the explosion in popular science literature. And the interesting thing about intelligent design theory is that you basically have people who are scientifically literate, though not necessarily in the subject areas that are part of the home base of Darwinism, but who are then kind of reinterpreting it in their own way without the biases that the Darwinian biologists bring to it. And so coming up with their own kinds of views about things. And that's, in a way, one of the ways in which intelligent design theory distinguishes itself from certain kinds of creationism. Though, actually, some of the older creationism also had scientists who were supporting them as well. Now, one thing that is distinctive, and I talk about this as the new twist, is the use of probability arguments. And you may know about this, Dembski in particular, the idea of a complex specified information or complex specificity, and this is the idea that if you to get an organism or some form of life that works in such a well-designed fashion, and if it were to be brought about through the processes of random mutation and natural selection, a la Darwin, then it would take an indefinitely long period of time for the thing to happen. Right, and that not even Darwin has postulated enough time for evolution to take place. So it's a kind of reductio of this kind of idea if you let random processes concatenate over a long enough period of time, you actually get something that's pretty reasonably designed. And so Dembski proposes kind of a mathematical way of thinking about this, which ends up saying, well, actually, we don't even think the Earth's that. Not even Darwinists think the Earth's that old. Okay. Now, of course, people can test the mathematics, and it is all very speculative, and I'm quite happy to leave the matter there. But the interesting thing about it is the literacy of the challenge that's being made there, where in a sense you sort of take the Darwinists at their word, okay, that there is no design or purpose in nature, that it is all brought about by some very fundamental mechanisms, and you see, okay, well, how long would it take? And then you ask whether the Darwinists actually do allow enough time for these processes to take place. So that's quite new, and that's quite a sophisticated kind of challenge to the Darwinian picture. Now, the twist that I introduce into this, which I'll bring up toward the end, has to do with what intelligent design theory says about us. As beings who regard science as perhaps a signature achievement of our culture or civilization, what does it say about our relationship to the world? And intelligent design theorists are very much mixed on this matter, and a lot has to do with the sort of clampdown on religious discourse in the public sphere in the United States, especially when it comes to science. People don't want to put their cards on the table, as it were. And so instead of this kind of picture of us as sort of junior intelligent designers, kind of small versions of God, right? We end up getting often a very sort of watered down version of intelligent design theory, the kind of thing that Dawkins ridicules, where really what intelligent design theory is about is not trying to figure out the designer's mind and how the designer designs, but rather just, observing that there's design in nature. That we are design detectors, as it were, and there's design everywhere, and this couldn't have just come about by accident, but we don't ask the question where it came from. Right? There's a lot of intelligent design theory at the moment that is of that kind, okay, which suspends the explanatory question entirely, and this is the kind of thing that Dawkins ridicules. Okay? But there is, in fact, precedent for that view, too. And so I want to go back to that kind of distinction between what intelligent design theory implies for us, whether we are intelligent designers too, or whether we're just design detectors. Okay. Now, why is intelligent design theory a big deal now? I've been giving you a sense in which why it's an important issue perennially. As a kind of basis for modern science, but why in this form it comes about now, and I think some of this you'll be familiar with already, and this very particularly has to do with the politics of science and religion in the United States, and the idea that intelligent design is a kind of stealth creationism. Now, this is something that was made very clear by the plaintiffs in this trial in Pennsylvania, where I was an expert witness in support of intelligent design. In 2005, Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District. There the idea was that the reason why the school district adopted a textbook on intelligent design, at least to have available for students if they want to look at it, there was no mandated teaching of intelligent design at all in Dover, was because earlier editions of the book were in fact a kind of a young earth creationist textbook that just in a way got reworded through successive editions and had some other additions to it. And this was a very kind of telling thing in the case, and it led the judge in his verdict to condemn intelligent design theory altogether, not just to condemn the school board for, as it were, hiding its motives, but to condemn the theory as well in all its forms. And this was something I think those of us on the defense side were not expecting such a strong negative verdict. We were expecting some negative verdict, but not as strong as that. And one of the bits of evidence that was brought up at the time was this document that was found in the Discovery Institute, actually on their website, called the Wedge Strategy. And this is the idea that intelligent design theory, because it doesn't officially make reference to religion, all the arguments are conducted in the usual currency of science, could be used as a thin end of the wedge to reintroduce a kind of Christian orthodoxy into American culture, which is sorely lacking at the moment. And so this document actually lays out quite a systematic plan, the kind of thing, as I often tell people, I think the way to think about this document is, the sort of thing that might have been found in Communist Party headquarters in the 1950s and from the other side of the spectrum caused trouble, right? I mean, I think it's very similar kind of thing because, there's just this document here. Why this document is so significant and scares people so much is an interesting question to ask. But the idea was that you would try to get people elected to school boards, and you'd try to get people, professors in universities and so forth, and gradually sort of build up this kind of cultural reformation of the United States through the education system primarily. That was the Wedge document, and intelligent design is the first step. Now, you have to combine this with the fact that ever since 1987, in the Supreme Court case of Edwards versus Aguillard, it's been made very clear that to demonstrate that there's religious motivation for the introduction of textbooks that are meant for public school science classes is unconstitutional. So the separation of church and state gets interpreted in this very, very kind of hard way, right? We're namely just indicating that there is religious motivation being smuggled in is enough to rule the book out, and that was amply demonstrated in the Dover case. But that's not... So in a sense, you might say, from the standpoint of the politics of the time, intelligent design theory looks like a kind of interesting option for creationists of the more traditional type to support. Okay, so that's one reason why it's a hot theory now. Another one has to do with what is actually going on in biology today. And that is to say, while there is a lot of lip service being paid to Darwin, in fact, the frontiers of biology are changing, moving in many different directions. Certainly the main frontiers of research have moved far away from Darwin's own base. Darwin had no notion of how the cell worked, had really no understanding of genetics, had very contradictory views on the matter. And in fact, the revolutions that have taken place in biology in the 20th century have been largely lab-based, have been largely the result of people moving in from physics and chemistry into biology. So they're not people trained in the natural history side of things that Darwin was. They're really quite a different bunch of people with quite different agendas, many of whom have been Christian, in fact. And those are the ones that have revolutionized biology. Okay, but nevertheless, Darwin's theory remains a sort of main explanatory framework under which all of these different developments are found. But as one fills in the pieces of the explanation of how it is that evolution happens, you get a lot of internal disagreements. And so for the past 25 years, you may know, there's been this sort of ongoing feud that ended only 5 years ago when one party died, right, between Richard Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould. Okay, where Richard Dawkins is a very strong believer in natural selection, understood in a very adaptationist kind of way, whereas Stephen Jay Gould is someone who really emphasizes kind of the really radically undirected aspect of evolution, so that there's a sense in which what in fact turns out to be the driving forces are sort of often, you might say, unintended consequences of the reproductive process. Okay. That kind of dispute continues to this day. There are a lot of geneticists who believe that, in fact, there is a sort of random genetic drift that's, in fact, the primary mover of evolution, which has nothing to do with natural selection and adaptation. And there are all these disputes that exist within evolutionary biology. And, of course, that is something that can be capitalized on, you might say, by people who want to propose a kind of radically different starting point from which to think about the nature of life. Okay, so there are these disputes within biology. There is no denying it. It appears in public. Biologists deny it sometimes, but I mean the evidence is pretty much out there. You can't, you know, that is kind of that there is this big disagreement within the biologists. And of course, one of the things that's come about too, and has become more evident and more publicized as well, largely through historians of science, is the what's regarded as an unsavory normative legacy of Darwinism. Okay, and of course, you know, the racism and Nazism. Again, Darwin himself not personally involved in these things, but people who invoke his theory have managed to get quite a lot of political and cultural mileage in a way they wouldn't otherwise. And I think one of the things that one finds, let's say, with somebody like Peter Singer, who I'm going to say a little bit more about later, in terms of his views with regard to what I call in a book I wrote called The New Sociological Imagination, I call this the casualization of the human condition. The fact is that if you start to think about human beings as not really ontologically distinctive, which is kind of the Darwinian view, right? We're just another animal species, right, who overlap with other species for whatever 97-99% of our genetic makeup, right? There's a sense in which there's a kind of moral level playing field. And what that should do, of course, is it should make us more mindful and concerned about the suffering and welfare of animals at the level at which they experience things, but at the same time, it shouldn't lead us to overvalue human life, right? So there's a kind of leveling process taking place where the animals are kind of raised and we're sort of lowered in the process. And what this means then is that, you know, you start to get a kind of normative framework that allows you to be a little more comfortable, you might say, with ideas like abortion or euthanasia. That is what I mean by, say, casualization, where the decisions can be taken a little more easily, because there's a sense in which there isn't this distinctive sanctity to life that has been traditionally associated with the privileging of the human condition, which is a theological idea, I would say, and remains a theological idea primarily until further notice, I think. And so all of these things disturb people as well, especially people who want to have a kind of integrated worldview. And, of course, Darwinism is itself increasingly being presented as not just an explanation for the nature of life from an empirical standpoint, but is also being presented as a worldview. Richard Dawkins, of course, being, you know, Exhibit A, but hardly the only one. And so people are now thinking, I think, in a much more explicit way than they had in the past, that you really don't have an adequate theory of science unless you can also account for what the science is for. What kind of a world do we want to live in as a result of the science we're doing, right? In philosophy, there is a branch of normative theory called axiology, which has to do with the nature of ends, right? What is the end of knowledge? What is the point of pursuing knowledge? It seems to me these kinds of questions are becoming much more prominent now, and it's one of the things that then leads people to wonder whether Darwinism is sufficient as an account of the nature of human life, certainly, or maybe life in general. And then there's one more factor, which is a sociological, very explicit kind of sociological factor, and that has to do with what's happened to science itself in society since the end of the Cold War and the sort of meltdown of nation-state funding for science. I mean, one of the things that's often not appreciated is that it was really in the post-war period that for the first time you start to get the kind of interlocking of research funding and funding for education in science and evaluation processes where you can really talk in a sociologically crystallized way about what Thomas Kuhn called paradigms. Right, where there's a sense in which there's a sort of concentrated control over the direction in which a discipline is going. Because in the past, of course, there have been peer review processes with regard to, you know, publication and so forth, but the money wasn't concentrated all in one place. People could get funding from various sources and so forth, and then they would do the research, and then they would try to publish in these peer review places. But after, in the post-war period, you start to get a concentration of science funding, a concentration of the agenda, right, and the idea that science is this very focused activity that is sort of on the vanguard of social progress, and of course going to be the vanguard of the Cold War, right, which was to a large extent practiced as a science race where all the scientists are kind of mobilized behind their national traditions. But with the meltdown of the Cold War economy, one of the first things to go was this kind of concentrated funding for science. So increasingly science has had to turn to the private sector for funding, which means that the agenda is no longer so focused, it's no longer so discipline-based, it's no longer so controlled by the academic peers. Okay, it is much more market-driven, and I think one of the ways you really see this is the fact that fields like physics and chemistry, which were very strong during the Cold War period under a lot of state funding, are declining, right? And that biology is expanding, but only the areas of biology that are market-friendly. Not ecology, not the field studies, right? But molecular biology and those parts of molecular biology that lend itself to the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, and those are the areas they're expanding at the moment. And so what you end up getting is, if you ask, well, you know, what does this all mean? Well, one of the ways in which I've characterized this has been in terms of a secularization of science that's going on. And what I mean by that is the following. Namely, I think of secularization as the removal of state protection for a church, where there's no longer a state church, and as a result, religions have to vie for the affections of the citizenry, because there is no state monopoly anymore. Well, this is what's happened to science. And in the wake of the secularization, where you remove state authority for religion, what typically happens is you get a lot of evangelizing in the religious groups because people have to start now making pleas for religion on the basis of what they can do for the consumer, the potential consumer of the religion, because nobody's force feeding it to them anymore, right? The priests aren't forcing them to do it. It's not required to go into public office anymore. So the question then is, why do you go to one church rather than another? Well, because it can do something for you. Okay. Now, science is appealing at this level now. So science is moving into its evangelical form, and so Richard Dawkins is a symptom of this kind of movement. Right? And what this does then is science, because it no longer has this kind of state protection where people were just forced to learn it, right? Now, science really does have to kind of present itself as a worldview in order to make itself attractive to people who have an option not to take it. Okay? And so this business about science is implicating worldviews. This is the sociological backdrop against which this happens, which starts to make something like intelligent design theory, you know, as a quite explicitly scientific worldview. It isn't anti-science at all, but it's anti a certain kind of authority, and the authority stands for a certain kind of view about human beings and reality that's very unpalatable to a lot of people, namely Darwinism. Okay? And so you now have an environment where there's a receptive message for that in a way there hadn't been before. Okay, so that's kind of, I think, gives you the sort of the full picture of what why intelligent design is such a big deal now and why it's unlikely to go away. I mean, at the moment, there haven't been any major court cases concerning intelligent design in the United States since the Dover trial, which was now almost 4 years ago. And the reason for that is the way the American legal system is set up, that if you, this is a civil rights case, and if you lose the case, you have to pay the lawyer's fees, right? You have to pay both lawyers' fees. And the American Civil Liberties Union racked up an enormous amount of money in supporting the plaintiffs who won the case. And so there's kind of a financial blackmail, you might say, going on, right? That you don't dare. You don't dare bring this issue up in your school district because Dover got bankrupted, because the American Civil Liberties Union promises to be behind anyone who's going to challenge intelligent design or creationism or any of these non-Darwinian views. So that is, I think, the main issue with regard to why it doesn't arise in the court system. But that doesn't mean there isn't continued interest, discussion, cultural reverberations, etc., about this. So this, I don't think this topic is going to go away very soon. Now, what exactly are the advantages that intelligent design have conferred to science over time, and maybe over not just to science, but to intellectual life more generally? And I want to turn to that for a moment, because this kind of brings us back and gives us a sense of the kinds of often taken for granted views that I think we might not normally have about science if it weren't for some presupposition about intelligent design. In the introduction of Matthew Made of Me, he talked about my stress on the intelligibility of the universe. Okay, and that's a very important kind of point, because there have been very many, almost all cosmologies have a kind of creation story. So there's nothing unique there. But the thing that's quite unique about the Abrahamic faiths, and especially the way it developed within Christianity, is this idea that the universe is intelligible, well, because as one of the ways in which one interprets having been created in the image and likeness of God is that our minds are sufficiently like God's mind that the way God designs the world becomes tractable to us. And so it repays persistent study. One doesn't get discouraged easily. I mean, one of the things that's very striking, if you look at a lot of the ancient cultures, especially the highly developed ones with very sophisticated mathematics and technology and so forth, including the Greek culture, is the lack of staying power. Right? These cultures and civilizations will come up with all these kinds of innovations the last like two or three generations in terms of their being propagated and developed and so forth. Then they sort of disappear. Okay, and largely because the dominant worldview starts to change, people kind of lose their confidence, they're not getting results, and as a result they go off and do other things. But one of the things that's very striking about science, and this is the idea of science as a lifelong intergenerational vocation. Okay, so that anyone who undertakes science now does so for their entire life. They don't just do it as a hobby the way the Greeks did it. Right, Aristotle says you turn to philosophy, you know, once you've finished a day's chores and you have some leisure. Okay, I mean, if in the Greek world, right, people didn't make a living by being a scientist. Right, in fact, this word only gets coined, scientist, in the 1830s to name a profession, and it's coined by William Huell, who of course was his natural theologian as well as a scientist, and was the founder of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and he wanted to give a name to the pursuit of science as a lifelong vocation, with the understanding that there would be successive generations pursuing this thing, each building upon the predecessors, like Newton says, building on the shoulders of giants, in a more progressive direction. This is not to deny there'll be errors and problems and setbacks and so forth, but there's this fundamental faith that reality is intelligible, and that as we persist, we will in fact get closer and closer to what that absolute understanding of reality is. Right? That's the old doctrine of scientific progress, and it's a very theologically based idea on the intelligibility of the universe. Now, even Immanuel Kant, as you probably know, believed that this was a presupposition for doing science. He didn't say this proved God, he didn't say that, but he did say that if you don't presuppose that, science becomes radically under-motivated. Okay? And so this whole idea that one pursues science into the indefinite future, that one continues to make progress, one has faith despite setbacks. I mean, if you look at people, for example, I mean, one person who, for me, is a very kind of liminal figure, you might say, between theology and science in this issue of intelligent design, and I recommend, if you are familiar with his works, you should go back to them, Joseph Priestley, okay, where you get this kind of interesting move from divine providence to scientific progress going on. Right, where there is this understanding that it's not going to be continuous, there'll be setbacks, but nevertheless we have a fundamental faith in the intelligibility of the universe that justifies us continuing on and on and on and on. Now that's a very profound kind of attitude toward the world, right? That represents a kind of confidence in having a certain kind of relationship to whoever is responsible for why the world is the way it is. And that attitude is a product of a kind of intelligent design theory, okay? And it's not one that you can find across all cultures, even though, of course, in other cultures you can find versions of the kinds of theories that have fed into this worldview. But you can't find this general worldview, and that's really important. In the first point that I make, I've been just talking about the second point, but the first point, the idea that science is theory-based research, right? Pure research, that is not merely driven by curiosity and practicality. Now, this is really quite an important point here. I mean, those of you who take philosophy of science, it's become, in a way, it's like philosophy of science 101 to say you can't do science without a theory. Okay, you start off with a theory and then you test it in some way. Now, that's an interesting point in itself. What is the idea here? Well, you need a conceptual framework. You need a projection of the universe. And the model for that way of thinking about inquiry is Newton. Okay, this is how people were imagining, certainly in the 20th century, not necessarily in Newton's time, but by the 20th century, how people were imagining that Newton came up with this kind of unified picture of physical reality, all the motions in the heavens and the earth under one set of laws, that it was that Newton started from the top. He hypothesized what it was like to think about things from God's standpoint. And the theorist is the person who occupies that standpoint, at least hypothetically. Okay, so in other words, you know, one does science not by being in the receiving end of phenomena or data, but by being in the position of a potential creator. And that's where the whole idea of doing simulations, doing experiments, or as it were, you set up model worlds and then you see what happened. You become your own mini god for a moment. Now that's a very important, see again, this is a very taken for granted kind of way in which we do science, but I think there's a reasonable question to ask, you know, why do we do it this way? Why is this the way we do it? Why isn't it just a matter of data gathering? You know, where the more the better. You know, why is it just pure empiricism? Right, isn't that how the animals do it? Right, isn't that what adaptation's about? No, we start from the top. Okay, and this is a remnant of intelligent design theory, one that's been very much, you know, secularized, sublimated, etc. But I think what I'm trying to bring up to you is the non-obviousness of this, right? That starting with a theory and testing it as a way of trying to comprehend the world is not obvious. It's not a trivial assumption to make. And one of the things that's been very much connected with that historically was the idea that we have special reasoning capacity that separates us from the animals. And in fact, when you look at in the 17th century, right, when the scientific revolution is taking place, of course, at the same time, there's a kind of philosophical revolution that's taking place, and we associate this with rationalism, Descartes, Malebranche, people of that kind. And these are the guys that we normally talk about as having put forward in a clear way the idea of a priori knowledge. Right, and a priori knowledge is typically mathematics, logic, reasoning, right, the kind of knowledge that we have prior to experience. Okay, now what kind of knowledge is this? Okay, and philosophers, of course, have discussed this in many different ways over the last 300-400 years. But the key thing here is originally it was thought to be that is the form of knowledge where we overlap with God. That is where we're participating in divine knowledge. And one of the ways you would see this is that with regard to mathematics, especially if one's thinking about something like Descartes' innovation of analytic geometry, right, what this enables you to do in principle is to be able to map out all of space and time, right, on a grid, as it were, okay, so that you can actually start to make pronouncements and predictions about things happening far away that you will never have any sensory encounter with, right, in any kind of direct way. You'll only have some kind of mediated encounter. right? We're able to postulate laws that govern laws of mathematics that end up enabling us to calculate numbers that we're never going to be able to see examples of because they're so large or so small. But nevertheless, we have these capacities. What is the nature of these capacities? Well, these were seen as the capacities in which we are participating in what God has. God, of course, has a lot more than we do, but we've got this overlap. There's a kind of overlap here, and that's what a priori knowledge was originally about. And that's why mathematics has always been such a kind of symbolic, iconic, you might say, sort of thing about what is distinctive about human beings, that we can somehow come up with these very wild and exotic kind of mathematical formulations that don't necessarily correspond to anything in nature immediately, at least at the sensory level, even though later on they end up often proving very important for physics. So non-Euclidean geometries, which had no obvious applications on Earth, become the basis for Einstein's theory of relativity 50, 60 years later, okay? But the geometries get cooked up first, okay? Now, the interesting thing is that when Darwinists try to explain the nature of knowledge, this kind of issue about mathematics and abstract reasoning and so forth, this is not really what they touch, all right? They sort of assume that all of this higher order stuff can simply be bootstrapped up from an understanding of how organisms deal with their environment through their sense organs. That there's a sense in which, you know, it's just a bootstrapped up version to get to mathematics. You know, what's infinity once you can count to five kind of thing. And so they really have not taken this kind of question seriously. And in fact, one of the points that I often make against Darwinists is while they spend a lot of time trying to explain religion, they ought to start trying to explain science. Okay, and that's to say science in this very distinctive sense that I'm talking about, where you're not just simply taking for granted that science is some extension of curiosity or some kind of, you know, animal instinct thing, right? But rather actually deal with the things that are very distinctive about science and try to come up with what would be a Darwinian mechanism to explain it, especially given the consequences of the knowledge that we've come up with this way. So, for example, think of something like atomic physics. Atomic physics, you know, result of very sophisticated mathematics, very sophisticated inquiries, most of which had no direct practical application at all. We come up with all these amazing findings that give us quantum mechanics and all the rest of it. And of course, downstream, there are some practical effects of it, of course, right? We get the possibility for nuclear energy on the one hand, but then we also get the possibility for nuclear bombs on the other, okay? And so from a Darwinian standpoint, is this the kind of knowledge we ought to be cultivating at all in the first place? Should we have been trying to do this kind of thing? But this is very characteristic of the kind of knowledge that human beings have come up with through science, right? Genetics is another good example, right? Where it enables us to address medical issues more effectively, but at the same time it also enables us to engage in various kinds of racial policies that are very destructive to the species. So from a Darwinian standpoint, is this worth pursuing? See, most of the signature achievements of modern science I think would be quite questionable from a Darwinian standpoint. We should be scaling back. Right? We should have more ecologically sustainable science, you might say, right, from a Darwinian standpoint. That would be, I think, the official line, which would rule out most of the 20th century innovations in science, which have been very much theory-led, right, driven by big ideas about how all of reality works. I noticed from my time, I've already been speaking for about 42 minutes. This is going to be an odd place to wrap up, but maybe I'll have to do that. One other aspect, and this, in a way, I think from a theological standpoint, might be the most interesting thing, and so I'll close with this. I won't show you the last slide, which would get us back to what the original medieval, you know, the founding moment where intelligent design really gets off the ground with Duns Scotus. I was going to say something about that, but instead I'll say something about theodicy. Okay? In my most recent book concerning intelligent design called Descent Over Descent, I talk about theodicy, right, which is normally nowadays understood as the problem of evil. How do you explain, you know, how could God allow evil and monstrosities and all sorts of catastrophes to take place? I talk about this as kind of the template for intelligent design, that this is where intelligent design comes from, the theological tradition. Because what people like, and I mentioned Malebranche earlier, and Leibniz, of course, is the person who coins theodicy as a term in the early 18th century. What is this view? Well, this is a view that basically starts with the assumption that, yes, God did design the world, did design reality in a rational fashion, and yes, there do seem to be a lot of design flaws at a local level. There's all this death, destruction, extinction, no one's denying this. And so then the question becomes, how do you square this? And the way in which this issue was originally posed in the 17th and 18th century, it wasn't posed as it were, a merely ethical issue. Right, this was an issue where there was no clear distinction being made, you know, between extinction, evil, death, monstrosity, these kinds of terms that in a way kind of blur the line between the moral and the natural. These were all part of the same problem. Okay, so the kind of thing that, let's say, Richard Dawkins would often use against intelligent design theory, like, you know, if God is this perfect designer, why are there all these flaws in things? Right, that would be considered in the same breath as one would consider the problem of evil, right? That those were part of the same problem back then. And there you start to get some very interesting kinds of ideas, ideas that I think, in a way, back up a certain very rationalistic understanding of God's relationship to his creatures, but one that is not necessarily sits very comfortably with the sort of pastoral orientation of theology. And I think this is the thing that really has always kind of minimized the significance that theodicy has had within theology. Okay, because basically, God is kind of a calculating being. I mean, that's one thing for sure. Because if you grant from the outset that there are these design flaws at a local level, and that somehow you have to justify them at a global level, right? God is a global optimizer. And if right? And so, you know, when you're a global optimizer, that means you have to make trade-offs along the way. Right. By the way, this is why engineers like this view, because engineering is based on global optimization, right? Where you have a lot of competing demands that you're trying to satisfy at once. You have resource limitations within which those demands can be accomplished. Right. So there's a presupposition that God struggles with matter. So one of the things that's interesting about the theodicy literature is how it appropriates the Bible, because, you know, in the 17th and 18th century still, people will, you know, quote passages from the Bible as evidence, as well as the stuff from science and philosophy and so forth. And the interpretation that's being given of Genesis back then is the idea that it's not whether, you know, God created the world in six real days or six symbolic days or something, but the fact that God took any time at all. Right? God's struggling. Right? God just doesn't snap the fingers and creation happens. And that's the interesting point, right? That there is some kind of matter is providing a problem, you see? And so there's a sense in which that kind of gets their imagination going, right? They kind of grant that, you know, that God may get what he wants in the end, but in the short term, there are problems. And that he might even need our help, right? Which is exactly, you know, theodicy as we move into the 18th century. And we get to people like Joseph Priestley, for example, right? We do start to get, you know, this kind of idea of historically temporalized versions of theodicy, right? Which, you know, downstream becomes something like Hegel's dialectic, for example, right? The cunning of reason, right? Where various things are happening, you know, that are means to ends that only get realized later. Okay, but what's the view of God that one... Now, the point here is, right, you can understand this from the standpoint of, you know, human beings created in the image and likeness of God, and God turns out to be this highly rationalistic, calculating, maybe political strategist kind of guy, right, who will sacrifice some beings in the short term so he can get the real thing in the long term. And of course, a lot of these philosophers who participate in this discussion kind of fancied themselves this way, so it's not too much of a problem for them, okay, because they're not actually... you know, in the business of saving people's souls. All right? But it does become a problem if you think about this as something that you would then use as an image of God to actually do any kind of applied or pastoral theology. Right? Because it's not a very warm, not very comforting, not a very personal view of God. It's kind of a God who operates on the principle the end justifies the means. Okay? And so this is one thing, but I do think that this is kind of where intelligent design comes from initially. And I think in a way this will always be kind of the problem that it will face in terms of convincing the larger Christian religious community. And to give you a sense that I'm not making this up, William Dembski's latest book, which will be coming out in the autumn, and I've just recently read the proofs for it, is about theodicy and intelligent design theory. And he came up with this without talking to me, so I didn't put it in his head. But it seems to me that once you really take this idea seriously of intelligent design theory, and you see God as this kind of big engineer, this global optimizer, then your image of God starts to change. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about Dembski's book, which I recommend to you if you get a chance to look at it, is he's really trying hard to sort of, keep the sort of personal view of God as someone who cares about us and so forth intact. He's really trying hard to do this. Whether he succeeds is another matter. But I do think that there is an interesting price to pay if one, in terms of one's conception of God, if one goes down the intelligent design route, namely God's ethics, you might say. With that, I will close, so allow some discussion to take place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. We have about 35 minutes for questions, comments, discussion. If you'd like to start.
Can you speak up a little bit? So,
just have a question of clarification, really. When you talk about what's worth pursuing from a Davinian standpoint in terms of the new player technology
yeah.
and so on, I wasn't sure what you meant by that, because from a Davinian standpoint, as I understand it, it's about giving explanations for the world and how it's evolved and how life has evolved there, and not about what's worth and not worth pursuing. And as for this development of technology, I would think that from a Davinian perspective, the capacity for abstract reasoning and intelligence is seen to be adaptive, that it has a competitive advantage.
Well, I mean, see, here's the problem.
It's survival, not about whether or not it's worth pursuing, really.
No, see, the problem is you can't ask the question from that standpoint, because if the thing's around, it's already adaptive. Right? The thing, since we have it, you can always make the argument it's adaptive. Everything's adaptive by that standpoint. Right? As long as we're still here and we're still using it, it's adaptive. That's all that, that's all you've said so far. Is that the Darwinian explanation? I don't think so. Darwinian explanation is that when there are options for which way to go, right, that it will go in a way that will increase reproductive survival and so forth. And it's not at all clear that that's what we've actually done. You need to look at alternative, you would have to go back in history and look at alternative models of where we could have gone, right? I mean, we... Well, I know. I mean, all you're saying is that the Darwinists need to provide an explanation. Seems to me that's all you're saying. Let's put it this. Let me ask you the question this way. If you're someone who, as it were, holds Darwin's view as part of your self-understanding, which is kind of what Dawkins wants us to do, right? And so you think about the world from a Darwinian standpoint. Would you be developing nuclear technology? No, because that's kind of where we are with this, right?
The thing is that there is no Davinian standpoint about morality, right?
Well, yes, there is. I mean, I don't know why you say that. Darwin himself had views. He didn't publicly,
Everyone has views. Everyone has morality, but that's not part of the Davinian. Okay.
I think the problem here is you assume there's a strong line to be drawn. And I think that's quite artificial. I mean, that's kind of the thing that I think is rhetorically done by the scientific establishment to prevent discussions of these kinds of matters by saying, oh, there's some clear line here where the science ends and the ethics begins. But where is that exactly? It doesn't appear in Darwin's writings, and most of these guys, once they start talking about human beings at all, from an empirical standpoint, immediately slide into the normative. I mean, you could say there's a distinction. I'd like to see where it is.
Right, we have several more questions. Daniel, then Paul.
I just want to try to help clarify the question of clarification a little bit. So I think probably one way to put it, and I don't know if I have this all right, but I don't know what inside and out evolutionary biology, is that evolutionary biology and Darwinism doesn't really have a teleology, or it's not. It's mainly sort of a, it doesn't have an end, which it's trying to reach, at least in its pure form, which she's speaking about. Instead, it's just a mechanism by which things have happened to be successful, because there's no designer behind it.
Right.
So this mechanism is trying to be successful. It doesn't actually have an end point that it's trying to reach. But that being said, because it doesn't have a teleology, because it doesn't have an ethics behind it from some designer, your point is well taken that people still do mix ethics with Darwinism and do say that there are reasons why we should do things that are based on the Darwinian thing.
I'd say something stronger than that, and this is where I give Richard Dawkins some credit. I think there isn't teleology in the traditional sense in which progressive theories of evolution were teleological, where, you know, human beings were the most evolved species in some kind of progressive sense, like Lamarck and others held in the 19th century. Certainly Darwin denies that. Life isn't going anywhere in particular. Yes, that's true too from Darwin's standpoint. But in terms of, as it were, what is the design of evolution, Richard Dawkins, I think, has a good point in pointing out the selfish gene. Right, that there's a sense in which organisms are vehicles by which genes reproduce themselves. Right? And that's what evolution is about. Right? And so whatever gets those genes recycled to the next generation, that's the name of the game. Right? And when one does game theory analyses of evolution, that is what one models. Right? So there's a sense in which that's the point of the game. That's the point of evolution, to keep the genes reproducing and recycled. Right? And so that's not a teleology in that strong, ultimate, historical, eschatological sense. No, it's not that. But it is a sense of what the point of the theory is, what the theory is supposed to be doing. What makes something evolved. You want to come back on that? See, because to say that something survives is to say nothing, right? I mean, everything then, anything that's here has survived. So therefore, there's a Darwinian explanation? Is this what the argument is?
Yes.
Well, isn't that a little strange? I mean, at least I'd like to see the explanation. Let's put it that way. One shouldn't assume there is an explanation.
Okay, let's move on. Paul, you have a question?
Yeah, I'm not sure we are going to move on. First question. Darwinian evolution does not explain conscious decisions like building nuclear weapons. It explains unconscious processes. You can't bringing together two things that can't be brought together.
Sure, but
nevertheless, I agree with you. We need to make moral decisions about technology.
Yeah, but look, I'm surprised you people are so easily separating these two things out, because I'm not even a Darwinist would do that, because Darwinists would say when you're making conscious decisions, there's stuff happening in your brain, and it's the stuff happening in your brain we ought to be looking at while you're mouthing the words. That's right.
Which is not necessarily part of this bigger thing about decisions about nuclear weapons. But every decision is taken within immediate context.
Right.
Rather than within the bigger picture, as I said, from the process of a genetic animal lecture, on the level of genetic animal lecture manipulation.
Right.
To ignore that environmental
By the way, you don't need Darwinism to accept your point, right? The idea that decisions are environmentally determined and so forth, this doesn't require Darwinism. I agree with what you're saying, but I think the fact that Darwinism is tied to it, Darwinism is a more general explanatory framework. And I think we don't want to get into the situation where, in a sense, to think about rejecting Darwinism is to reject everything about genetics, molecular biology, and everything we already know about biology from an empirical standpoint, because that's completely false. Right? That this is really kind of a dispute about ultimate explanations. This is not a dispute about what's going on in particular disciplines at the moment, most of which don't need to make reference to these debates at all. And I think that's a very important thing as we have this kind of discussion. Because sometimes I think you think that if I'm telling you, you might want to think twice about Darwinism, I'm somehow telling you might want to junk all of biology. And I'm not saying that at all.
Okay, Michael.
I wonder if you could comment on how intelligent design handles the question of creatio ex nihilo. In particular, when you talk about this overlapping of attributes between the creator and the creation, it seems that that moves away from the more orthodox, the small o, notion of the ontological separation between creator and created, which is reinforced by creation out of nothing. And so I'm wondering how Dembski et al. Are handling this particular strand, this non-Dionysian strand of Christian thought.
I'm trying to think whether there's actually an answer that I can give you as the official answer.
Okay, as the official
answer. Yeah, where there is an answer to that. What do you see at stake here? Just so I can get a sense, in case I need to invent an answer, I'll get a sense of what the spirit of the question is a little bit.
I suppose I am just purely curious about the place of this traditional Christian doctrine associated with the doctrine of creation.
Mm-hmm.
Something that has, Paul Tillich said that creatio ex nihilo.
Oh, I see. So the fact that the God struggles with matter, you mean that's kind of the issue here with you.
Bit. Okay.
Yeah,
maybe that's a little bit.
Right, yeah.
You're scratching the surface there.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like a Zoroastrian kind of thing, not properly Christian, perhaps.
Well, yeah, maybe it's a little too Persian for
me. Yeah. No. Okay, I'm trying to get the vibe here,
Yeah, I'm defending little O orthodoxy,
Right.
God struggling with matter, too much, I think, a presumed ontological overlap between creator. I would imagine that Dembski and the crew would wrestle with this, since it's so central to... The
yes, in this book that I mentioned before, I think the key issue there is more about making God look good.
Yeah.
Right.
That's such an American way to do theology. Put him in a nice suit.
No, it's an interesting point. I guess because I don't struggle with it personally myself, I'm quite happy to accept the Zoroastrian version of Christianity,
Okay. I'll go back to Rome.
If I could ask a question.
Sure.
I like the way in which you related notions of intelligibility to particular post-enlightenment notions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how it might be made sense of. It seems that you were citing a set of plausibility structures that are transnational, if not global, in their prominence and scope. Would a more subtle analysis be afforded by taking into account structures that were more locally based, or at least were shaped by the national boundaries of scientific discourse?
Well, I guess what comes to mind is, of course, the way this kind of movement has been playing out in some place like Turkey, where I think that there is an intelligent design movement that's largely of Islamic origin, but has been, to a certain extent, mimicking the stuff that's been going on in the Christian world. The political environment is quite different. The function that it plays in the society is somewhat different. All those things are true. But I do think the tendency is, at least basically, I'm just speaking as someone who's kind of, as it were, participant observer in all this, is that the different strands are coming to terms with each other more. That there's a mutual recognition that's taking place among these different national traditions that and religious traditions, of course, that hadn't taken place before. So yes, in a sense, there's intelligent design happening in several different places, motivated in quite different ways, perhaps, but they are gradually, I mean, I think this is one of the things that scares people, right? Is that there is this mutual recognition taking place.
So is it a symptom of globalization?
Well, I do think globalization is wearing, yeah, it's moving this along, for sure. I mean, I think one interesting aspect of this that's kind of related, which I find always frustrating, is the fact that because of the American nature of the discussion, as it moves over here, British people start to think there's separation of church and state. Right? I mean, you start to get British people making these American arguments, and you're wondering, what country do you live in, guy? Well, I mean, you know, so, I mean, there's a sense in which that aspect of globalization, if you think of it as Americanization, has in a way kind of complicated the discussion. So, in other words, it's not all to intelligent design's advantage at all, the globalization process. Because there is a tendency for people in other parts of the world to think they're America.
Peter.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you something about the British context to this. Mm-hmm. First issue was there was that case recently, wasn't there, of a scientist who was forced off the, was it the...
Oh, the science communication director of the Royal Society, Michael Rice?
Because mm-hmm. he was not hostile to intelligent design, or not perceived to be sufficiently hostile. I don't think he was particularly an advocate.
No.
But he was not willing to rule it out. And that, so that was an interesting development. But my main point was, the impression I have, the attitude of the mainstream churches in the UK is that they don't want to talk about intelligent design. They really want to keep not get involved in that kind of territory at all, because they don't want to be contaminated by creationism, and they don't want the cultural, mm-hmm. culturally negative
yes, sir.
Attitudes that mm-hmm. apply to it. So they have a kind of complete, there's a complete unwillingness to engage in that area. So you get some Anglican theologian, but there are one or two scientists who are actually ordained or whatever, and they have their own personal ways of coping with this. But as far as I know, they don't advocate explicitly
that's right.
intelligent design. And I find that's curious.
Yeah.
And I wonder how long they can keep on with that situation, because if you're advocating a culturally appropriate version of Christianity, what do you do with creation stuff? If you're not going to be a creationist and you're not going to be an intelligent design person, what are you?
You're a theistic evolutionist. I know. What is that?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to see. Because I think certainly sort of left Guardian readers run a mile when they see intelligent design.
Oh, I know. I'm one of the people they run away from. And I'm on the left.
I'm at the door, and then I think, well, maybe I shouldn't kind of jettison the whole lot.
Well, I mean, I think the issue here, you know, to not to get into issues of people's personal psychologies and, you know, whether they're courageous or cowardly or anything like that, but at an intellectual level, there is this business, you know, Gould's idea of non-overlapping magisteria, which I think a lot of these theistic evolutionists take quite seriously. And for them, that's kind of a godsend that he came up with this idea, where, you know, science and religion operate on parallel tracks, you know, maybe separate realms of being. They're quite compatible in that separate but equal way, like we used to say about racial segregation in the United States. No, I mean, and I think that's kind of where those people are, right? And this is where the whole idea of saying, you know, science only deals with the natural and theology with the supernatural is rhetorically very important for these guys. And intelligent design theory, of course, you know, brings up the possibility that science might deal with the supernatural. Right? If you talk about trying to infer what the intelligent designer is like. So it blurs that kind of boundary that they want to keep intact for, I think, cultural reasons. Because there is a sense in which once you open that up for public discussion, it's true, especially in this climate. It's very interesting to see what will happen.
Yeah. Jim?
Yeah, Steve, I have a question about where intelligent design might go
in
the future. We've had a conversation about this before. I'm interested in the notion of co-evolution.
Co-evolution. Between what and what?
Between humans and something else.
Oh, okay.
Whatever that is. And how Bill Bainbridge and his chums have been working out ideas about the future, implying that in effect science fiction is already here.
Is it transhumanism? Yeah.
It seems to me that could be seen as the next stage. If not,
Why not?
Oh, you know.
Why do you draw the line?
The singularity is near, man. Ray Kurzweil. No, it's too bad I didn't have time for this. But you know, interesting point, right? The Discovery Institute, when this book came out, Ray Kurzweil's book, The Singularity is Near, which is a few years ago, very much in this transhumanist vein, you know, we're going to be able to sort of download our consciousness into computers and all that kind of stuff. There was a major symposium conducted at this book at the Discovery Institute. Okay, they didn't. Now it's interesting to see, you know, and there is a, and you can get a book that actually has a transcript of the debates about this, where Kurzweil, Dembski is there, John Searle, the philosopher of mind, a lot of very interesting people talking about this prospect that you're raising here. And I think the thing that is fair to say is the objections aren't so much along the lines that they don't object to the possibility of, as it were, translating the spirit or the mind from one medium to another, but that to somehow talk about, you know, whether the mind still has some kind of detachability at the end of it. Okay? And that's what they really want to hold on to. But the whole idea that there could be some translation that takes place from the carbon to the silicon-based medium, right, they're willing to play with that. Okay? I mean, I gave it a very respectful hearing, much more respectful than you might have imagined. John Searle was, in fact, the biggest objector, because John Searle, of course, has this rather common sense view, right, that the mind's embodied in the brain in a pretty serious way. Silly man, right? How 20th century.
I don't have a question. You have a very powerful answer to everything.
Oh, no, I don't. It's just my voice.
I'm not feeling comfortable with your use of the word Darwinism and Darwinist, mm-hmm. because it suggests an ideological block. It suggests that it's a kind of sect of believers in Darwin, kind of cult of Darwin or something like that, and it is clearly a polemical term. Mm-hmm. Darwinism and Darwinist, it is used by opponents of theorists of evolution as to describe them as one block, and that's a question which is very often raised by a biologist who try to discuss, to dispute creationism and intelligent design. For instance, a German biologist Ulrich Kutschera, mm-hmm. is very active in defending biology in Germany from alleged, you know, attacks of creationists and proponents of intelligent design. He repeats that in the 1930s in Germany there was a very familiar term, Einsteinism.
Yeah, sure, with the anti-Semitism thing, yeah.
Anti-Semitism, mm. And it was also a term who labeled every new physician.
Yeah.
So I'm not comfortable with the use of Darwinism in this context, scientific context. It's my comment. Also, evolutionism isn't, in my opinion, a proper term, because evolutionism suggests a very early paradigm of a social science, which can surely be accused of being responsible for that racism, what you showed us on the first slide or second slide,
mm-hmm.
but not the, it wasn't a Darwin idea.
Okay, several points. First of all, the people who were talking about the Einsteinismus were Darwinists. They had racist, the anti-Semitism was fueled by certain kinds of Darwinian views, the ones who were talking about the Einsteinismus, okay? It's an ironic point, but it's true. Also, it's a mistake. I don't know, people who support Darwinism tend to think that only the opponents talk about Darwinism. In fact, Darwinism is very widely used in the philosophy of science by supporters of Darwinism. So you have books called Living with Darwin, Can You Be a Darwinian and a Christian? These are books written by Philip Kitcher and Michael Ruse. Daniel Dennett has no problem calling himself a Darwinist. Richard Dawkins in public appearances uses the term as well. And I think there's something quite specific about about Darwinism, right? Because Darwinism is not any old theory of evolution, right? As was brought out earlier, right? The purposelessness, right, is very important. The fact that the evolution is not going anywhere. The sort of relatively species egalitarian view, where humans are not particularly privileged in the process. You know, the role of random mutation and natural selection as given prominence. Those are very distinctive features of Darwin's theory of evolution. If you believe in a theory of evolution, you don't have to believe in all those things. You probably believe in many of them, but you could believe in some other things as well. You could have a more purposeful notion of evolution, for example. Okay, so it seems to me that Darwinism isn't just a term used by opponents. It's a term that, in the philosophical realm, I mean, the fact that scientists, because I've also heard scientists make the kind of objection you're making, and I think all that shows is that evolutionary scientists don't read much philosophy of science. Because they don't realize that the philosophers who are defending them are using Darwinism all the time. And in fact, that's where I think the creationists get the language from, to be perfectly honest. I think they get it from the philosophers, who are the ones who are primarily doing the sort of front work. You know, Michael Ruse and Philip Kitcher and those kinds of guys, they're the ones who are often doing the debates with the intelligent design people more than the scientists are.
View from nowhere. Maybe you're trying to do such a meta-analysis about both parties and not standing here as one of these parties.
No, but I guess I don't see the problem with using the word Darwinism in this context, because that is the specific theory that people have the objection to. Okay, and a lot has to do with, you know, the implications it has. I actually don't think it's so much the implications for God. I think it's more the implications for human beings and the sort of the status of human beings in the theory. I think that's the main problem with the theory. Okay, it deprivileges human beings.
Okay, Ralph. At one point you mentioned a sort of connection between the marketplace and the secularization of science, and you drew attention to that. And when you did so, sort of one name immediately sprung to my mind as having something to do with the marketplace and also drawing on Darwin and also having things to say about religion, and that's Hayek. Now, I'm not sure whether sort of Hayek's catalysm has just failed the test of natural selection, but
no, it's the prototype for it.
If it's possible to conceive the market in those terms and also to conceive religion in those terms, is it possible to I just wondered what your opinions are on whether Hayek throws any light or shadow on what's going on.
Well, I actually think Hayek is very much in line with a kind of, if not exactly a Darwinian picture, I think very much, because Hayek's general metaphysical framework is very much like the Scottish Enlightenment people, who are very often seen as the precursors to Darwin's view. So this whole idea, I think this was a point that was raised earlier, that when one talks about Darwinian evolution, one is always talking about adaptation and survival very much at local levels, right, where local things are happening. And this is very much kind of the Hayek picture of how the market works, which is why it's impossible to get any kind of collective understanding of how markets work that is going to be smarter than what the individuals making the particular decisions on the ground are doing. Right, and in a way, this is kind of the Darwinian picture of evolution as well. Right, there is no grand goal, there is no point, there's no direction that, in some sense, you could hasten evolution toward. Right, rather, evolution is kind of the emergent effect of all these different organisms doing all these things they do, and then seeing which ones actually reproduce more successfully in the long term. Right, so I mean, they do have that. They're sort of metaphysically quite similar, right, in that they're very skeptical of any kind of macro level, you know, teleological, large-scale kinds of understandings of things, right? So just as there's no intelligent designer in Darwin, there's no central planner in Hayek, right? I mean, I think that's the analogy.
So does that help explain sort of what you're saying about the marketplace and the secularization of science?
I wasn't actually thinking of it in those terms. I mean, I was actually thinking in terms of as using the marketization model to understand what is happening as science has been fragmenting. Because see, one of the things, the point I was trying to make is that with the end of the Cold War, right, we're losing any sense of a univocal image of science, because in the past that image was maintained by there being a certain kind of authority that the state backed through funding, through dedicated streams of education and so forth. But that's increasingly fragmented in the post-Cold War era, and scientists, as it were, have to justify themselves more from scratch now, which is to say they have to move down to the level of the people they're trying to attract, because people are no longer being forced to go into science or encouraged so strongly. So they have to actually make a stronger pitch at the ground level to people. So it's marketization in that sense, right? It becomes demand-driven rather than supply-driven.
I think Gordon was first, then Richard.
Alongside the kind of creationist interest in intelligent design, you're probably aware that there's another kind of secularization of science on the religious left around the universe story, and Thomas Berry and Brian Swin's work, which has had quite a significant impact in kind of left-wing and environmentally conscious groups. Do intelligent designers make any use at all of theories of fine-tuning of the cosmos? Is it biology and no cosmology?
No, it varies. I mean, these guys tend to play to their strengths. I mean, I think that's one thing that's kind of interesting, is that the proponents of intelligent design theory do come from different configurations of disciplines. The physics guys have not been so prominent, but they are, the fine-tuning arguments do get used from time to time. I have seen them used, but you're right, they're not too prominent.
With the 150th and the 200th anniversary of Darwin this year, I came across something called, I think it was the Thiel's think tank, Rescuing Darwin.
Yeah, they failed.
They seem to be saying, well, in actual fact, he never denied a theist position.
Sure.
Are they sort of trying to actually reclaim Darwin? Well,
what can I say? I mean, this is where the issue of Darwin matters, right? I mean, Darwin obviously has some very important cultural iconic value, right? So people want to kind of be on the right side of this issue. I mean, there's a very interesting biography that's been that was published, I guess, a month or two ago by Adrian Desmond and James Moore, basically about Darwin's anti-racism. Okay, and you know, Darwin being very, his family being very strongly anti-slavery and all this, and the book is kind of an almost like an apologetic in case people had thought Darwin was a racist, you can rest assured he wasn't, kind of thing. And the interesting thing about that book is that Darwin looks the best in terms of his anti-racist attitudes when he's still close to those early Unitarian origins of his family. So when he's a young man, right, he's still influenced by that stuff. But as he gets older and moves farther away from those theistic roots, you know, even though, you know, very abstract notions of God these Unitarians believe in, but nevertheless, as he moves away from it, he actually sees race much more inscribed in the human condition. So he becomes much closer to kind of what people demonize him as. I think that's part of what's going on in the case of Theos, because in the think tank report that you're referring to, they make reference to that biography, right? Which in a way kind of shows that Darwin is at his best from a kind of ethical political standpoint when he's still closest to that Unitarian background. But of course, that's not the whole story of Darwin's life. Darwin just gradually, you know, moves farther and farther away from it. I do think, though, that there's no denying that Darwin's theory of evolution is compatible with a kind of theism. And Darwin didn't deny this himself, right? But it isn't monotheism of the Abrahamic religions, because there isn't this image and likeness of God, there isn't this kind of intelligibility issue. None of that's in Darwin. It's more compatible with a kind of pantheism, perhaps, right? Where you have natural forces that, you know, that operate out of their own accord, and evolution is sort of their outfolding, right? And you can call that theistic if you want. And maybe that's all Theos is, you know, happy with. I'd be a little surprised, since it's supposed to be a Christian think tank. But it seems to me you can get some kind of theistic view. It's just a very weak kind of pantheistic view. Right? If nature's your God, Darwin can give that to you. What he can't give you is a kind of, you know, personal, you know, image and likeness of God kind of God.
Time for one final question, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, in one sense, I'm completely disinterested in this.
I don't think I've ever heard that such a first sentence before.
What did interest me about your opening standpoint was beginning to take us into the social context within which these thoughts emerge. Mm-hmm. Now, I think our colleague's comment here about the ex nihilo argument is a very good one, because in one sense, there is a very strong stream in Christian theology which wants to say God did this stuff, and it was really good, actually. It was really rather good. And that's that. There is that other argument of idolatry. Now, my basic comment is framed by the concept of fear.
Mm-hmm.
There is the issue of idolatry. These guys who talk about this sort of stuff are men and women who are afraid in life and in the world. This is my a priori existential statement. They are afraid. Theologians are afraid, philosophers are afraid, scientists are afraid. So they engage in idolatry. We know that we are meaning-making animals. We don't know much more than that as an a priori, I think. So, to me, it is really interesting that the reason I'm disinterested in it is because so many people engage in issues about creation of all shapes and forms is that there's an extreme theological, biblical naivety on board in terms of essential mythology. We are playing mythological games. And I remember Paul Kinghorn coming and giving a great address in Durham Cathedral. And doubtless he is a significant physicist, mathematician. But at the end of the day, all he wanted to tell us from the pulpit of Durham Cathedral was that God is love and God loves us. You don't have to be on FRS to say that God loves you. And in fact, the bridge between the two is really complex. So what I'm really saying is that you've given us a brilliant example of it, and in that I did really enjoy, of the complexity of the interplay of the arguments.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sense that great superstructure has one or two rather fragile foundations to it. And one of them is a biblical naivety of biblical and theological understanding of creation stories. So the creation story is important. My final comment is this. It is extraordinarily interesting in Darwin's book on emotions, for example, that occasionally he has a kind of an allusion to biblical theological stuff. There is one story where he talks about an issue, and I will mention it in a minute, and there was an absolutely obvious biblical analogy he could have drawn immediately, and he did not. And that's extraordinarily interesting in terms of his own development into agnosticism, creative agnosticism. And it was when he told the story about a hippopotamus that was giving birth, and it was so extraordinarily painful that it sweated blood.
Mm.
Now, he'd read his Bible well enough to know that Christ had sweated blood in Gethsemane. Mm. But did he dare draw the conclusion? Which must have been in his mind without any shadow that he did not. That's, in a sense, it seems to me, the expression of, what is it? Is it fear? I don't know.
Hmm,
that they are random thoughts.
Hmm, that's interesting. No,
Do you have any
random thoughts?
I'm sure you did.
Yeah, I know. Was there anything else? Or?
Did you want a response to it?
No, I think I'll let that stand. That's fine. It's interesting. But
well, I think we need to draw things to a close. Steve, this has been a fantastic session.
Well, thank you.